I'm Gavin Moore from PwC. Welcome to session 8A, which is a joint session doing a scheme update for both Return to Work South Australia and the Tasmanian Workers' Compensation System. We'll start with Michael Francis doing the update on Return to Work South Australia. Michael is the General Manager of Insurance of Return to Work SA. He has spent the last 5 years leading critical elements of the transformation of the South Australian Workers' Compensation Scheme and insurance business to one that is delivering significant better outcomes for workers' injured people and their employers. Michael has 18 years of experience in insurance and injury management in both operational and senior executive roles. Experience across many and varied workplaces for both regulators and insurers in Queensland and South Australia has provided Michael with a well-rounded perspective of the opportunities and challenges facing the industry. Please welcome Michael.
That almost sounds like a CV. all right, so before I actually get into the presentation proper, I just wanted to start with a quote which I've been using a bit internally and with some of our claims agents to help describe where I think we're at in the South Australian scheme. And that quote is that success is not final, failure is not fatal, it's the courage to continue that counts. Does anyone know who said that? Hard to see from here, by the way. There's a lot of lights. Okay. That's Winston Churchill. Obviously, there's a few quotes of his floating around, but I felt it was just important to kick off with that because we know that in recent times we've had some successes in South Australia, but we're not under any illusion that those successes, when put in the context of the scheme's history, have been for about 5 minutes. And really, if we look at the history of the scheme, as far as the expectations of employers who pay our premiums, workers that we provide services and make payments to, and our owners being the government, we believe we've been quite a ways behind the eight ball in that sense. So I'm not going to go through where all the numbers in terms of how our performance was at, but I mean these are some headline metrics that a lot of schemes measure their performance with, and it was fundamentally broken with a lot of dislike in the space across most of those for a long time. And if I just pull out one of those in terms of being unfunded, I think in the scheme's previous history since 1987, I think there was one very brief period in which it seemed to get itself to being fully funded, and that was it until relatively recent times. So, but as far as the people who we're set up to provide a service to by way of insurance and return to work type services, the employers and the workers of South Australia, we weren't delivering on the sorts of outcomes that they were looking for from us either. So from the 1st of July 2015, it's reasonably well known, I suppose, that we became Return to Work SA, a rebranding and repositioning of the organisation that coincided with a new piece of legislation which absolutely helped us in the sense that it reset some of the parameters within which we were working. So I don't intend to go through all of these key features now, but it just gives you a bit of a sense of what those new parameters were. But I will highlight two or three of those at this particular point in time, the top one being the service standards. We had service standards written into our act that was put in place, being the Return to Work Act, and at least as far as South Australia is concerned, and to the best of my knowledge, I'm not aware of service standards being part of any other corresponding types of legislation around the country in that sense. So we felt as though that was quite important to how we formed our own operating models to deliver upon what, I guess, the responsibilities we're charged with. The other point to highlight is the two tranches of benefit that were available or are available within our current scheme, and those being that tranche which are available to people who are considered under our Act to be seriously injured, who get income support through to retirement age and lifetime care and support by way of medicals, etc. And then there's the two-year cap scheme that's available for all other people within the scheme, whereby they get 100% of their notional weekly earnings for a year, 80% for the following year, and up to a further 12 months worth of medicals and what I'd call other types of supports paid for to help assist them, as well as the two different types of lump sums. That's just the background side of things, background to this. Really, in terms of the scheme update, I just wanted to highlight that really, as far as the what I believe the recent successes that we've been able to maintain are concerned, that really the service reform is both the core and the key to what it is that we're trying to what we're achieving by way of desirability in that sense. So without that, and with just the legislative changes alone, yep, we would have had a reduction in some liabilities and would have been able to get away with charging a lower premium for a while, but we would have lost an enormous opportunity in terms of realising some of the true value from a desirability to our stakeholders' perspective that we really could realise. I mean, we exist to meet a social charter, and we really need to aggressively make sure we continue to pursue that. So we're very focused on making sure that we continue to improve in that sense. But I'll come back to that shortly, just some basic numbers, and I apologise that the last of my financial years dropped off this chart for some reason, but what I can say is that in South Australia we've had reducing claim numbers for quite some time, but over the last 3 years, if you add 2017 onto that, they've been quite stable. For all intent and purpose, we're a small scheme and we've been sitting at about 14,000 claims a year for the last 3 years. From an eligibility perspective, whilst you've got some raw numbers there, really what I'm trying to show you there as well is that not a whole lot's changed in terms of the proportion of claims that come into our scheme which are accepted, those which are rejected and those which are withdrawn. So even though we've had some heightened bars with respect to eligibility, it's only led to relatively small changes in that space. Net promoter scores got mentioned quite a bit yesterday as a way of looking at customer satisfaction, and that's certainly what we've been using in South Australia since we first started along the road of trying to get more engaged in a face-to-face way with our employers and injured people. And since that time, this profile of returns in terms of those net promoter scores has remained relatively unchanged. That said, I think Mark Coyne mentioned yesterday, and these results reflect that, that for EML, and certainly it extends to the other claims agent in South Australia, being Gallagher Bassett, about 80% of the results that we're getting back from both employers and workers suggest that through returns of 7 or better out of 10, that they're quite satisfied with the service that they're getting. And that's reflected similarly for both employers and workers. We measure them at the point post first face-to-face service, and then again when some sort of benefit ceases. So in that sense, it's hopefully not just through rose-coloured glasses of when you first provide, I guess, a pleasurable experience for those people. One point that I did want to highlight, and I highlighted it at another conference I was speaking at probably 6 months or so ago in WA as well, that it's a misnomer to believe that somehow or another service alone is going to help drive some of the results. Some of what we saw in South Australia was that when we were introducing our more face-to-face service provision, that whilst we had always these quite excellent, really, service scores coming back from the people we were providing service to, our results didn't reflect the improvement we were really looking for early. It was when we really started to ramp up the concepts of service with a purpose that I felt as though we started to make some of the more sustainable improvements we've seen over the last 18 months. So I apologise that the last complaints figure's not complete there either, but what I can tell you is for 2017 we finished up around 370 or so complaints, which was a 40% reduction on the previous year, which you can see year on year has been another good space for us, tending to indicate that that the workers and employers that we're dealing with are happy with some of the changes that have been occurring. Probably the most important measure that we look at as schemes, and certainly as Return to Work SA, where, I mean, we're a return to work scheme, are the return to work results. So if you look at the left-hand side up there, you can see that at work, which is people achieving full return to works as a percentage of all the claims which come onto our scheme. Now, that includes those who might not have lost any time. For the 2017 year, we had at 4 weeks, 75% of those people at work, 13 weeks, 83%, 26 weeks 87% and 52 weeks 88%. And I can tell you that they were the results for the year, but since then we've seen continued improvement, and those numbers respectively are now at 4 weeks we're looking at 79%, 13 weeks 87%, 26 weeks 91% and 52 weeks 92% for our most recent results. So, but probably more telling is the right-hand side of that picture for mine. So if you look at the people exiting your scheme, and I know criticisms of at least some schemes around the country are that we measure return to work by people getting cut off our schemes, which isn't the way we should be looking at those things. And if we look at just purely the people exiting our scheme because they have either achieved a full return to work or they've ceased income support because they're earning more than their notional weekly earnings, we've seen those numbers climb from 71% of people exiting for those desirable reasons in 14-15 to 87% leaving for those reasons in 16-17. They're compelling numbers, and we absolutely are proud of those, but aren't under any illusions, as I was referring to with that opening statement, that that if we don't continue to improve, that we will maintain that. If I look at the psychological injury claim space, we haven't had the experience of a number of other jurisdictions who are seeing the increases in that space in recent times. That being said, this is purely looking at the performance of the premium paying scheme, and in South Australia we don't have the public sector agencies within which I know this is a significant problem as part of that premium paying scheme. So that's, I'm sure, part of what's probably shielding us from some of that, but it's just highlighting that we're fortunate that that hasn't been the case. If we look at dispute numbers in the scheme, as just another indicator for us, you can see there that the sections to the right of that particular screen, which are showing the number of disputes lodged every month, are the monthly results since the new scheme came into effect, and it's quite clear that there are significantly less disputes. The blue bars represent disputes lodged by, or the blue portion of the bars, I should say, represent disputes lodged by people who'd transitioned in out of the old scheme, as we refer to it, whereas the orange bars are those people whose only experience has been the service received under the new model. And it's clearly something that we're very focused on keeping reduced, and we feel as though, well, you can see from the numbers there that it is. Quickly touching on the premium space, we're now charging 1.8% on average of wages to employers who are insured with us, which is lower than the schemes historically had. And again, whilst we know that that's not necessarily competitive compared to many other states, it's certainly the best that we've been able to achieve in South Australia. And if I talk about complaints in that space as well there, for the 52,600 employers who pay us a premium, we've seen the complaints come down from anywhere between 200 and 600 over the last 10 years when I looked at it in terms of the numbers received relating to premium, to having had 40 in the last financial year relating to premium. So it's a significant reduction. Clearly, in an environment when premiums are coming down by the proportions that they have, you're going to get less complaints, but the simplified premium system that we've been able to introduce, which has certainly helped, we think, employers to understand in that space as well. So I'll keep pressing on because I know we've only got a relatively short period of time. These are our latest valuation results, and I don't want to focus overly on the pure numbers for the numbers' sake, but just from a scheme design perspective and how it plays out. I spoke earlier about the different, effectively, the tranches of benefits that are available to people who are considered seriously injured, who have that longer-term benefit structure in place versus the short-term. I just wanted to point out that you can see up here the respective liability that sits between the seriously injured cohort and then the shorter tail cohort, is that such that it's just under 2.5 times the liability within that much smaller group. So it's clearly a critical measure for us to keep an eye on with respect to both liability but also pricing for the future in terms of the number of people who go into that more serious injury cohort. So, and I've also got just a point up there about the current funding level. So I'm just going to flip through this one pretty quickly too, because releases for whatever they're worth, all I'm doing there is just really trying to highlight that for eight successive half-year periods now, we've been able to achieve some releases, which I think has only heightened the responsibility that we have to make sure that we continue to pursue some of that social agenda more aggressively, given the stability of what we believe we've got working for us at the moment. So really just to finish with, before I give you an opportunity for some questions, and I'm not sure how you want to run it, Gavin, whether you want to just go straight to Brad's presentation, I just wanted to talk about what I saw as really being the affordability and durability risks for our scheme. The graphic on the left-hand side there is really meant to represent the need for us to continue to improve the service capability of our people. If our scheme doesn't continue to deliver improvements in results in what is what most people recognise as a high-intensity service provision model, then it starts to undermine the return on investment and why you're actually doing this. And we're really clear about that need to continue to invest in that space, particularly as in the front line, as it were, because we have been doing this for a relatively short period of time. The steady improvements that have been achieved, particularly over the last 18 months, that continue, in part, I'm sure, about getting that capability mix right with respect to the behaviours and the nature of the interactions that we have with both employers and injured people in such a way that we can get the what I would describe as more constructive results for those people in their lives. So that's the capability risk side of things. The picture in the middle is probably slightly controversial. It's a book that some of you might have read. It's called When There Are Too Many Lawyers, There Is No Justice. And that's as much as you can say with all due respect to the legal community when you've got a slide like that up there. We know that we need our service model to do more in terms of preventing people from having to seek out the counsel of lawyers to help get them through our scheme. And if we've got there is a place for lawyers in our scheme, but if there are too many, we know that that will undermine what it is that we're trying to achieve by way of objective results for those people. But as far as the affordability of our scheme is concerned, it's effectively a frictional cost as far as I can see it. Our schemes don't collect money from employers by way of their premiums to put money in the back pockets of legal firms. It's there to provide services to injured people and make payments to them as we need to. So we really need to work hard at drawing that side of things up for our scheme. The other part there is, I guess on the far right, is danger due to misinformation, if you can't see that. We've got a scheme review coming up that commences at the end of this calendar year. It's got a report that needs to be handed down within 6 months, and in the middle of that time frame, we've got an election. So if these sorts of scheme reviews have the potential to be overly politicised, this one's got that on steroids, so to speak. So, and we know that we need to do as much as we can to put factual information out there to give people the real information upon which to make decisions in and around whatever recommendations that review comes up with, because we understand, as most of the people in this room do, that there will be veiled vested interests who will try and potentially skew that debate with misinformation. So we need to do what we can to not so much control the narrative, but inform the narrative as best we can in that space. So I'm going to wind it up there and just leave it at that quote that I left you with to begin with, and that's really just reinforcing that whilst we know we've had some recent success, we know that that won't continue unless we continue to innovate and try different things that'll help keep us moving forward, and understanding that we shouldn't be scared of making mistakes in that environment. We just need to continue to have the courage to continue and stay on that path. So thanks very much.
We're running out of time, but we do have time just for one or two quick questions. If there's any questions from the floor? No burning questions?
Good.
Thanks, Michael. Interested in how you're looking at return to work rates, and you mentioned that a lot of schemes historically have looked at when people exited the system as a measure of return to work, which it clearly isn't in a lot of cases. Can you just talk a little bit more about how you're actually measuring return to work and any challenges you've encountered in doing that?
Yeah, sure. So we've actually only relatively recently, when I say relatively recently, we started in January, but it only came into our formal way of measuring our claims agents' performance in this space, having it such that we've gone away from payment-based methods which had all the lags and other sorts of things which could get in the way, which where we knew weren't a true indicator of return to work, where it's a requirement for our claims agents now to, at different intervals, based upon their knowledge of the worker and recording of the basis upon which they've entered in the status of that worker, record what their return to work is. It's not payment-based. It's based on their knowledge of where the worker's at and the performance remuneration of our claims agents as it relates to return to work, which, by the way, is the sole performance-based measure beyond the KPIs that we have, is one that is locked to that. And so we obviously have significant assurance measures in and around the validity of that information, and our claims agents understand that obviously if gained in any way, shape or form in any sort of systemic way as distinct from error, that it can result in some pretty significant consequences for them. So we're confident that's not what's going on. So it's very much an understanding of where the worker is at in a given point in time in terms of their return to work. It's not about payments.
Great. Thanks, Michael. We might leave it there.
Thanks.
We'll invite Brad up.
Wow, you're not kidding. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for coming along. Today's presentation, I suppose, in sharing with Michael, the Tasmanian scheme is certainly significantly different, being a privately underwritten scheme. I will take the opportunity to boast that under the National Return to Work Survey, we're currently the highest in the country at 92%. So we're privately underwritten. We have 7 licensed insurers, 10 self-insurers. Our claim numbers are around the 7,500 per year. And I'll go into a little bit more detail a little bit further on. Premium pool of about $160 million. My presentation today will focus on scheme design, scheme performance, current projects and questions to align that with the changes, the challenges and opportunities as outlined in the theme for the exercise. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about changes because there's not much to talk about in the performance of the scheme. It's travelling pretty well. We don't see any major fluctuations. There's nothing out of control. So probably our greatest risk at the moment is political risk, which I'll talk a bit more about in a moment. So just delving back into history, 2010, we made some major legislative change to shift the focus into injury management, that provided a greater focus on injury management, less focus on claims management. As a consequence of that, we're just starting to see probably the benefits of the return to work rates and the improvement in getting people back to work. In 2013, we had a change of government and they introduced their red tape reduction agenda, which, of course, we've all probably gone through that and seen that it actually generates more red tape than it actually gets rid of. And then in 2016, there was a bill introduced that sought to make some changes and get rid of all that red tape. And they kick off on the 1st of January 2018. Just want to touch on some of those changes. Tasmania's been in the fortunate position of having medical practitioners accredited for many years. I've had conversations with numerous heads of workers' comp authorities and they're a bit of an envious that we are able to get it in and get the doctors involved and be able to engage with them as part of the process. Well, guess what? We're going to give it away. we're removing our accreditation process under the basis that it was perceived as being a red red tape component. So now we're going out to any doctor or any GP can issue certificates, which will no doubt cause a raft of problems. We're removing job seeking from our preferred providers, so Tasmania aligns with the HWCA national inconsistent framework for rehab providers. And as a consequence of that, we've gone even a little bit further to be more inconsistent and removing job seeking from the prescribed services as part of that process. The big ticket item is the functions and the membership of the WorkCover Tasmania Board have been reshaped, and that involved moving from a representative-based board to a skills-based board. That obviously that can be quite a contentious issue if you're losing a seat at the table, so that took a fair bit of pain and suffering to get that through. The new board will kick off in the new year, so we'll see what that brings. Unfortunately, we didn't get the ideal board makeup on the basis that one of the functions of the board, or the board has administrative activities across three pieces of legislation, one of which is the Work Health and Safety Act, yet we continue to have a board with no expertise in work health and safety, which is always a little bit problematic. We're adopting the Safe Work Australia deemed diseases list. So that's got mentioned, I think, yesterday about moving to some sort of national consistency. But of course, just to be inconsistent, we'll put a modifier over it and modify it to the way we want it. So, that's just what we do in state-based jurisdictions. We're also introducing a death claim form. We've been largely criticised for not having something in place for many years in that space. We've clarified the guidelines for the assessment of permanent impairment. That's just an administrative thing. We're removing the age of 65 for retirement as a prescribed age and aligning with the pension, so that'll allow us to eliminate the gap as the retirement age moves and those sort of things. So it's that's a benefit. We've had an excess in the scheme for a number of years now, and it was never indexed to inflation. It was never indexed in any way, shape or form, so it's the same as what it was set back in, I think it was about 2005 or 6, I think we introduced it. As a consequence of that, it's now $200 and the first week of benefits. The insurers say it costs too much money to administer it, so they were successful in removing that. I don't know what behaviour change that's going to drive once it's gone. Obviously, we'll see an increase in claims, I suspect, but we'll see how that plays out. It is funny, well, there is some irony in the fact that the insurers are now complaining about the process of removal, even though they wanted it removed. But anyway, that's part of doing business in workers' comp world. Extending the review period for our presumptive legislation, so we have firefighting provisions in place that provide for if firefighters get certain types of cancers, then there's a review, then they're entitled, it's deemed as being linked to their employment. There was a provision in there that said we reviewed it annually. We've now pushed that out to every 3 years, purely administrative function. And we're also expanding eligibility for dependents in the case of death, so we have quite a narrow definition of who's eligible for receiving benefits, so we've expanded that out. We're also taking the opportunity to remove renewal requirements for licence conditions. So typically we had a 3-year licence period where a self-insurer or a licensed insurer would come in and then every 3 years go through that process and we'd give them another ticket to operate for another 3 or up to 3 years. We've bitten the bullet and said there is no renewal period now. Once you're in until we kick you out, essentially, or you want to fall out. And that goes for licensed insurers, goes to self-insurers, and also goes for accrediting doctors to assess impairment. I would also, at this point, make the comment that in doing this, the board recognised that it needed to reshape its regulatory model in the way it regulates licensed and self-insurers. So we're moving down the process of trying to improve our data and intelligence gathering using
relying on information we collect through other sources rather than going directly to the insurers and self-insurers to provide that information. Things like financial information, we'll get that straight from APRA, and we'll be able to, you know, the financial information coming through annual reports, all that sort of stuff will disappear as part of the process. The other major issue is that we have a strong work health and safety component within our self-insurance arrangements. They need to comply with the National Audit Tool. They need to maintain the standards in that space. We're softening those a little bit, going to each self-insurer on an annual basis and say, well, tell us what your health and safety program is for the next 12 months and then, or 2 years, and then we'll fit in with that in regards to our audit processes. So what we're trying to do is align our activities with those of the self-insurers. They're supposed to have mature and complex systems. What we're seeking to do is just to piggyback off the back of that and grab the information at the appropriate time, so it's probably less about time-based provision of data. And we've moved from our audit process, we've moved from to an annual audit process to a two-year process, and they need to do their normal surveillance audits as part of that process. So back into the legislation, we're also the requirements around return to work coordinators currently sits at 50, and we've kicked it up to 100. We're removing the archaic process of displaying a policy in the workplace, which will certainly make it a bit easier for employers who don't necessarily have the space to put bits of paper on the wall. So they were the changes that came through under the first bill, and then we kind of got wrapped up into a... thought it was such a good idea to do it, we'd sneak another couple of bills through. So we heard another bill come through last week, and what that seeks to do is remove the time limits for eligibility for firefighters, and also remove the number of incidents that that volunteer firefighters need to attend, which was currently set at 150. There was no science when they came up with that number. There's no science behind the whole volunteer firefighters presumptive legislation that I can see. But anyway, as a consequence of that, we're now in a position where it'll be unlimited access, so there'll be potentially 5,000 volunteer firefighters that don't have any barriers coming through. The net consequence of that we'll see, I suspect, a pretty significant increase in premium for the fire service as part of that process. In addition to that, and some of the other schemes may be aware, there's been a bit of a push to get post-traumatic stress disorder as a deemed disease by one particular union. They've made approaches across a number of jurisdictions. Rather than, well, the science behind it doesn't suggest that it should be made a deemed disease. There's not a lot of benefit in actually deeming it, because it's still a recognisable injury as part of the scheme. But there seems to be this view that it should be flagged as a deemed disease, yet the Safe Work Australia document list of deemed disease specifically excludes it. But anyway, so in order to be seen to be doing something in that space, we've inserted a provision into the latest bill that talks about an annual review around post-traumatic stress in respect of whether it should become a deemed disease as part of the document, hence the reasons for the need for a modifier over the Safe Work Australia document. So should this thing ever get up, we're able to insert it in over the top of the Safe Work document. I won't dwell too long on the scheme performance. As I've mentioned before, 7 licensed insurers, 10 self-insurers, 17,000 policies. The scheme, as I said, is travelling quite well. Insurers probably aren't making as much money as they would like, but it's a relatively stable scheme, with over 80% of employers continuing to stick with their insurer, so there's not a lot of churn across the scheme. We typically run through, and through the assistance of our actuaries, PwC, we work out what we would like the scheme to, or what the actuaries think the scheme will look like in 12 months' time, and then track the progress over the coming year as to see what it looks like. And as I said, we don't expect there'll be too much churn. Obviously, above excess claims, given that we won't have an excess, will probably disappear as part of the process, but and I guess, as I said, I expect we'd probably see a bit of a bounce in claim numbers moving forward. Weekly payments, all that sort of stuff is pretty stable and not changing much, and we don't anticipate much change in the coming year. Our premium rate's about 1.86, so it's not too dissimilar to the South Australia model. We're not getting a lot of pushback from insurers and employers and I said these random things coming from some of the unions in regards to supposedly improving benefits. As for current projects, we're tied up quite closely with the health and safety regulator, so we do both the prevention and the compensation. So some of the projects that we're running through in the current year is obviously reviewing the role of the regulator. A number of jurisdictions have gone through that process in recent times. We've just come off the back of a pretty successful WorkSafe month for 2017. Our strategic plan falls over at the end of this year, so we'll be we're in the process of developing a new five-year plan moving forward that focuses both on workers' comp and health and safety. We're planning to undertake a broader community awareness program in early 2018 that focuses on community understanding and awareness, and then leading into community engagement as part of WorkSafe Month 2018. And we're also in the process of reviewing our safety awards, which we've moved to a two-year cycle. In the compensation space, we've reshaped our regulatory framework, and we're looking at doing some work in our medical certificates. And I take it from the way the bells are ringing that we're getting close to kick out time. So, and then the final issue that, you know, we're also dealing with are mental injuries, and whether or not there is a better way to compensate mental injuries moving forward. And I think, yeah, certainly what we've heard today and yesterday all adds to that discussion around whether or not workers' comp schemes are the right place to deal with those sorts of issues. So,
thanks, Brad,
for that great presentation. We might leave questions just to time constraints, but I'm sure Brad would be more than happy to catch up with you after the session. Please join with me in thanking both Brad and Michael for their insightful presentations.